promise that in this next session we will not say anything about sex. Okay. I wanted to first address the... we had a conference in Joburg this year, Youth and Family Conference, this last July. And it was a great success. We had over 700 people at this conference. And it was the first time we've done a Youth and Family Conference in Southern Africa like that. We are already have it scheduled for next year. And we're very excited about our guest speakers coming in this next year. But the conference is scheduled for for June 17th to the 19th in Joburg. And some of our closest friends, A.T. and Marcy Arneson, who lead the church in Chicago, are going to be in speaking at that conference. We also have a potential of having an elder couple coming in, and I can't tell you who that is yet because we haven't figured it out. But we're working on that as well. And we're going to try to do one of the... One of the sisters brought up a really good point here that I wanted to just share. I know that a lot of times in these classes, look, we've got two classes, and they're 45 minutes each, and you try to hit the big general principles. The problem is a lot of us aren't in this big general principle place. We don't live there. For example, some of us are married to non-Christian spouses, and that changes some of the dynamics. And we can't get into a lot of those specifics when we're just talking about the big principles in a limited time. Same thing is true when we get to parenting things. Some of us have blended families, we have adopted children, we're in different scenarios, and we can say some of these big principles apply, but to really address those specific things, that's the reason we try to do conferences like this, so that we can have classes where we deal with those things. So unfortunately, we just don't have the time to get into a lot of that, but that's kind of the reason for that. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk through the heart of why we're doing this real Christian parenting section the way that we are. When you think about your children, most of the time, our kids, by the time they're 18 years old or so, they're on their own, right? We send them off to university, they get a job. But in reality, this is when we stop having the daily influence with our kids, right? Now, sometimes. Some of our kids are 28 years old and are still at home. That's another conversation for another day. Anyway, but the point is, the way I think about this as a parent is, look, when our kids are born, you know, to this point, there is a certain amount of things I'm trying to accomplish here as a parent. And right now my kids are falling, you know, on the 13 and right near the 15 mark. And so I'm looking at this going, wow, my time is getting really limited. And about a year ago we had a family devotional with our kids and I said, I really want you to know what it is that I'm trying to do with you before you leave at 18 years old. And I keep telling my kids, this is when they leave. So they're getting that part down. It's not that I don't love my kids, but I want them to be adults and to start their own life. So the point is, I made a list. I said, let me explain to you what my goal for you is. And this is why I do what I do as your parent. And I had a list of, you know, spiritually where I want you by the time you leave the home. And I want you to understand financially where you should be when you leave the home, meaning you know how to budget, you know how to use your money properly. You know, I want it socially, what my goal is for you before you leave home. Does that make sense? And we had this whole list. They weren't very excited about this devotional. I was. But the good thing here is it at least helped us get on the same page. And it was a good communication for my kids to understand, this is why mom and dad do what they do with me. This is why I have to do chores. This is why we're being taught how to be giving and have friends. Does that make sense? Yeah. All right, now, we're not going to deal with all that. We're only going to deal with this one aspect, the spiritual aspect. But when your children leave home, what really matters? By the time they leave your daily influence, there are two things that you want them to deeply have ingrained into their lives. One is they need to know how to love God, and they need to know how to love people. Isn't that what our faith is all about? And when you read Matthew 22 and you read, you know, what the greatest commandment is that you love God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and that you learn how to love your neighbor as yourself. This is the reason why Beth and I chose today to make this the heart of what we're going to be talking through. How do we do this? And if this is what you get done, good job, Mom and Dad. We broke this into a couple sections. You'll see this on that third sheet on your handout. Loving God, we broke down into walking with God and discipline. Let me explain why. To love God requires that personal devotional side. That's the walking with God part. But there's something else that I've seen in my 20 years being a Christian. If you don't have disciplines, internal character discipline, you don't make it.
That's right.
It's hard to love God without discipline. So you get excited emotionally, but you don't have the character that it takes to run the marathon. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that when we're instilling this into our kids, why discipline is so important. When you talk about loving people, there's a lot to that, but we broke this into four main categories. One is just this general sense of giving, how a person constantly learns to deny yourself and push past and love people. That is the nature of Christianity. But then we kind of talk through some specifics. We're going to break down hospitality, loving the lost, and loving the poor. And how do you train your children to do those things as they grow up? So what we're going to do is Beth and I are going to actually take turns with these. As you see on the right side, the different scriptures, all the ones that say Proverbs are the ones I'm going to be addressing. The other ones are the ones my wife's going to be addressing. Let's turn it over to her.
Again, I'll just repeat what I shared at the beginning. Whenever you stand up and say anything about your kids, you just immediately feel humbled. You feel like, oh, Lord, help me. You know, because it's a roller coaster ride, and we're all buckled in for the ride of our life. There's days when it's just everything seems to be going really well, and then there's days when, wow, you know, you feel like, God, did you know what you were doing when you gave me these children? Can I handle this? You know, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm alone in that, but I have days like that. And like Dave said, we'll share just general principles, and I know everyone in this room is in a different place. How you came to be a parent is different. You know, you may be raising your grandchildren, you may have adopted children, and you may have had them all biologically, but it's all... you're a family, so here you are, and so here's some principles that hopefully we can all lock into. And I think another thing is I can look at a list like that, and where we talked about earlier, we all have our kind of our default mode we go to. Mine can tend to be toward the little overwhelmed, and I'm like, oh, no, I have this whole list of things that I'm responsible for. And so it helps me when I don't think that way, and I just think, My theme scripture for mostly the last year is give us each day our daily bread. And each day has enough trouble of its own, so let me today. So that's where I have to live every day spiritually, but I do have to have a plan or I will be going nowhere. With no direction, you go nowhere. And so I think it is great to have the big picture, but for you, for yourself, you have to find, I think for the women, we have to find what grounds us every day. And for me, it's give me my daily bread. That's about all I can all I can do is today. So anyways, but I've been reading this book called Sacred Parenting that I wanted to share this quote from. And the theme of, if anyone read Sacred Marriage or Sacred Parenting, the theme of these books is that we're all in the process of, it's the why of parenting, and that we're all in the process of being purified ourselves as we are a parent. And this quote I liked from it, it says, our own spiritual quest must drive our parenting. Unfinished or neglected spiritual business inevitably works its way out through our relationships in a negative fashion. We become more demanding, more controlling, more intolerant, more resentful. Our spouses or our children cannot quench the God-given spiritual hunger in our souls. When we neglect God, we ask our marriage or our parenting to become stand-ins for God, something they were never designed to do. Christian parenting is a sacred journey. It invites parents to purify ourselves and use the process of raising kids to perfect our holiness out of reverence for God. And I love that because I think it gives me a perspective that I'm not raising these kids to please myself. And I can get demanding when I think sometimes I'll fall into, oh, if you do that, they're going to think, what kind of parent does this kid have? Because they're doing such and such, or they're acting out. And I used to, I'll confess, I used to, when I didn't have kids, I used to look at some parents who had little kids who were climbing the walls or doing whatever, something I felt was inappropriate, and not knowing the whole situation, of course, I would have these things of, I'd probably never do that, or like, she should get control of her child. And then I had my children, and so then you're the one who other people are looking at, you probably thinking she should get control of her child. So this, I love this concept of not the how-tos and that it's all perfect, but I love that it's the why. It's why I parent. And it's that I'm becoming more pure out of my reverence for God, and I'm learning this through the vessel of parenting or marriage. It calms my soul. But the two parts of this passing on our walk with God to our kids, I think two of them are modeling it. Of course, this whole live it to give it concept. But another quote I love so much is, and Dave referred to something similar about the fifth gospel, but it says, 100 people, one will read the Bible, 99 will read the Christian. And I think that's the world we live in. If you're a Christian today, you know that. You know that you're supposed to be this light on a hill, you know, giving, glowing to the rest of the world. And I think as parents, even before, when we're holding our babies in our arms, all the way till they're grown, they read us. They're in our homes. They're watching us. They watch how we respond. And we have to do our best to model Christianity to them. I think a practical way of this, and I'll walk through a couple of stages of that we've been through with our kids, but in Psalm 78, verse 1, I'll start in verse 2. It says, I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things, things from old. What we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from our children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power, and the wonders he has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so the next generation would know them. Even the children yet to be born, they would in turn tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God, and they would not forget his deeds, but they would keep his commands. And I love that. It's so practical here. It talks about passing on our faith, passing on our God story to our children. We will not neglect that. We will tell them the praiseworthy deeds of God. And that can start from when your children are such a young age. They see it through your relationships. They see it through, as you grow up, telling them your story about how you got to know God and how you started coming to church. And some of you, they're watching that right now, if you're just in that process yourself. But I think we can forget the whole modeling thing. We can forget that we are the main character in our kids' God story. We're constantly, at every age, we're trying to teach them, you know, age-appropriate things of how to connect to God. But we're the main character. We're who they see. We're the starring role, whether we like it or not. And that's kind of a lot of pressure to put on us. But we have to simultaneously be figuring out, okay, for this child and their temperament, what's going to connect them to God? And then we have to think, what connects me to God? And let me share that. Let me pass it on. Let me tell him. Something we've had in place our whole time being parents is just we always committed to having a meal together every day. And some days, if that couldn't be dinner, it was primarily dinner. But that sitting around the table, and what that has grown into over the years, you know, we'd tell, when they were little, funny stories, or we'd talk about our day, and what'd you do today, and da-da-da. We'd all go around and share. And that's continued now to the ages that they're at. And it sounds so simple. But yet in our busy, crazy lives and changing jobs, and that simple principle of sitting around together, whatever you sit around, just that passing on, I feel like that's where we tell the praiseworthy deeds that God has done that day. it gets talked about in our family. I think that's changed over the years, but it started off when we have our daughter, who is almost 15. We had her biologically, and our daughter, who is 13 now, we adopted her from India. And we adopted her when she was 13 months old. And so I had an almost, like a 2.5-year-old and a 13-month-old. So I got two toddlers, right? Right? I did go through the baby stage with Maddie. And I felt immediately this sense of, what? How do you have a quiet time with two toddlers? I don't know. I can't just seem to even get through a page, and because they were so busy and, you know, into things. And if you turned your back on them, a lot of things could happen that weren't going to be good. And so I remember just at that stage, one of my first things was I made them these little bins or baskets or something, and I put in some colors and some paper and things like that, and each day when I had my quiet time, they would sit down and they had to have their quiet time, and it would be drawing, and we'd go on a walk around the block, and I'd pick up leaves and they'd tape it to their paper, God made leaves, and you know, just that. But I remember having to creatively think, okay, here, I don't want to stop walking with God. What am I going to do with them while I'm trying to walk with God? We're going to have to do this together. So that's just one example, the nature walks. And then they grew into where they started learning to read, and we made little books, God Made Girls, and we talked about happy days and sad days and, you know, days when you don't feel like being nice to your sister. And we'd draw pictures and we'd fill in the blanks, and to family devotionals. We've always been big believers in having just regular family devotionals. And we would do these devotionals of, do you ever do the let's do it the mean way, let's do it the nice way devotionals? And as they were growing up, they always loved the let's do it the mean way one. Like, let's answer the door and be mean to the person who comes to the door. And they'd be like, ah, you know, or they'd run and turn their back on the person. And they always, oh, pick me. I want to be the mean one. I want to be, and we're like, what does this say about like that they always want to be the mean one? Yikes. But from singing to reading books, right now it's progressed, and we've just kind of kept this habit of now we're reading 1 Samuel as a family, and we just read a chapter and we talk about it. And we're just trying to model and get our kids, whatever age they're at, to connect with God. And I know that if you're new and you're coming in and your kids are older, some of these things, maybe you don't have these habits or patterns. I think, like with the getting help point I made earlier, you can always start somewhere. You can get them connected with somebody, and you know, you come to church, you meet some people. Maybe there's an older student that they would connect with, and just start having great conversations with about God. So wherever you're at, I just encourage you to start from there.
Okay, we can turn to Proverbs chapter 5. I will say parenting is one of the most humbling things in my Christian life, because in a lot of other areas of your life, you know, you feel like you have control. And with your kids, you just feel like, wow, I don't have control. And so it's instilling these heart things in our kids and hoping that it takes. And a lot of the things we're sharing with you today, for us, we've been working with teenagers now for the last 11 years. In Chicago, we were asked in 1999 to take over the teen ministry. We were leading a region and started getting involved with the teens. And one of the things that we saw very quickly was successful families and unsuccessful families. And you start seeing patterns. So a lot of these things we're sharing with you, some of them are our experiences, but a lot of it is what we've seen helps families be successful in raising their kids and what doesn't. Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 21 says, "For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all of his paths. The evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him, the cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for his lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly." As we're training our children to love God, we do have to do, and what Beth said is true, we've done so much over the years to instill God into our kids. And at every age, you have to be creative with how you do that. Also knowing that even though we don't see the direct result of this, what we're doing to train them in having healthy boundaries is going to long-term be as important as how we instill faith into them to help them to make it long-term. And for us, you know, and it says here, he will die for his lack of discipline. I was baptized in 1990. I've watched a lot of adults walk away from the Lord because they didn't have the character to stick it out. And I've watched a lot of teenagers get excited when they're 15, 16, 17 years old about their faith and get baptized into Christ. And when they got to, when things got tough, when they were 24 and 25, they walked away from the Lord. And the kids that make it are the ones that learn how to persevere because mom and dad have given them character. They've instilled boundaries. It's very important if you're married to another Christian that you're constantly in communication about what those healthy boundaries are and that you're unified, that you are one. And God tells us that when we get married, the two become one. Our kids should always feel like if I talk to mom, it's the same answer as if I talk to dad. This is where a lot of the work comes in as parents that a lot of us aren't willing to do. And because, I mean, look, I was talking to one of the brothers at the break. The truth is, we all came from very different homes, right? The way I was raised and the way my wife were raised were completely different. And especially early on as parents, if I do by default what I think is right and she does by default what she thinks is right, we're going to be going two different directions. But it's taken us a lot of time to communicate with each other about, okay, how are we going to handle this? And then with the kids, we have a unified front. So they feel like there's one answer. Now, the challenge for this is if you are a Christian trying to raise your kids and you're not married to a Christian, it doesn't mean that you don't need to work as hard at being unified. You still do. But you also, it does present some more complexities to your situation. Obviously, if you're a single parent, then you just got to be unified with yourself. Amen. Let's go over to Proverbs chapter 16. There's a lot of scriptures here I want to encourage you to go back and look at, but I want to hit a few of these. Proverbs 16 and verse 20. This one says, whoever gives heed to instruction prospers, and blessed is he who trusts the Lord. God is telling us that those who learn to obey are successful. One of the earliest things that we have to do with our kids is teach them to obey the first time. And you say, why is it the first time? Because you're training a heart. And when our kids are 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, 6, 7, I mean, you know, then you start losing the. But it is a, you need to obey, and it needs to be immediate. And if it's not immediate, there's a consequence. Because you're training them to accept authority. Now, the truth is, when you're 40 years old, you still have authority in your life. And when you're 50 and when you're 60, you're never going to get to a place where you don't have authority. You're always going to have the civil authorities. You're going to have a boss. You're going to have a church leader. And we all know how challenging that can be. We have to follow authority. It's one of the most important lessons that we teach our children. Now, let me tell you something, parents who have younger kids and who right now think, I love my baby too much to spank them. You don't love your baby. Yeah. Kids that grow up that have the hardest time in their teen years are kids that were not spanked as young children. Yeah. Teens that grow up and then go out and try to carry a job or have to deal with a boss when they get their first job or deal with professors at the university who were not taught to obey when they were children have the hardest time as adults. You're not loving your children if you do not create healthy boundaries. Proverbs chapter 23. It's ironic how much the world influences us when it comes to discipline with our kids. And it's funny, in a lot of ways, we're really strong about, hey, the Bible is different from the world and the world is separate. And but you know what's interesting? For some reason, when it comes to parenting, especially younger parents that haven't been ingrained some of these teachings into them, they're much quicker to pick up a parenting book and try to learn alternate methods to discipline than to use the very things that God tells us is critical. Yeah. Proverbs chapter 23, look what it says in verse 13. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. I had an interesting conversation with my 13-year-old this last week. We had just left church last Sunday where we made the public announcement that we had to disfellowship a brother for being sexually immoral. My 13-year-old had all kinds of questions. Dad, why do we do this as a church? So we do this as a church because if we don't uphold God's standards, this man could lose his soul. The Bible is very clear about the reason we disfellowship in 1 Corinthians 5. We put him out of the fellowship so that he feels the sting. We cut off all relationships so he feels the sting. Why? Not because we don't love him. It's because we love him. So that he will somehow come to repentance and come back to God so that he may enter heaven. And I said, Maddie, it's not unlike why, as a parent, we spanked you. Some parents think it's loving not to spank their kids. She says, well, you didn't struggle with that one when we were young, did you? I said, no, because we saw from the Scriptures how clear it was that God told us how we were to love you, and we trust God. And if we love you the way that God calls us to love you, we believe that the results will be what God intends them to be. Now, as our kids got older, you know, it's not always about spanking. It's not about, but it's about creating healthy boundaries. And we found for our kids, and these are some of the things we chose to fight with, to set boundaries, and you're going to have to choose your own. But for us, TV, we've seen so many kids grow up, and they spend 3-4 hours a day watching TV. It creates laziness and all kinds. I mean, it fills them with things in their heads that they shouldn't have in their heads and in their hearts. And we were very particular when they were younger. We still do it today, where we know what they're watching. And we always, for our kids, had a 1-hour rule. You never watch TV for more than 1 hour a day during the week, because there's way more to do with your life than watch TV. And it encourages them to play with other kids and read a book and do some homework and interact. I mean, you're not going to sit there and, you know, and just stare at this. It's horrible what it can do to us. Internet. From the time our kids were little, we've sat side by side with them, training them how to use the internet in a healthy way. When we set up their first email accounts, we had every email that went to them came to me. And they knew it. They knew I was watching how they were interacting with people on the internet. Facebook. Our kids, you know, 13 years old is the legal age your kids have to be to have a Facebook. If you have a child that's under 13 and has a Facebook, if you didn't know this, they had to lie about their age to get that account. It's actually legal. Our kids need to be 13. So, when our children turn 13 years old, it was a big part of their 13th birthdays. Let's sit down as a family and let's make a Facebook. And guess who your first friend is going to be? You know, it's us. And why is that? My kids know I'm on their Facebook every day. Every day I'm watching. Why? I'm training them. What are the kind of things you should and shouldn't be putting up there? What pictures are and are not appropriate? How should you be communicating with boys? And it's training. It's training. It's training. It's boundaries. There should never be another. The other thing for our family is we didn't feel like it was appropriate for our kids to have a phone until they were 13 years old. Because they don't have the maturity to handle it properly. And so again, that's part of it. When our kids are sitting there and they're, you know, mix it and they're on Facebook and they're with their friends, we sit down next to them, hey, who are you talking to? It's just a normal part of our conversation. And if they ever go, oh, you know, then whoa, 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 that's unhealthy. There's no such thing as dark places in our family. We live openly. That's part of training healthy boundaries. Sugar was a big thing for us, you know, when they were younger. The goal is to try. I want them to be healthy when they grow up. I don't want them to have this out of control discipline because we didn't instill in them. We're always trying to help them go to the gym with us and, you know, eat properly. And those are just things you train your kids. The last thing I want to talk about with that is socials. And in the U.S., it was dances. And the way they interact with boys and what happens at these functions when they get in high school. Of course, we worked in teen ministry. We knew At these dances at school, the ungodliness that happens at these dances is horrible. And so our kids knew from the time they were small, okay, this is a fifth grade social and they're playing some music and that's fine. You're going to be able to do this in grade 5 and grade 6 and grade 7. But let me tell you, by the time you hit high school, you're not going to be part of these socials. Because we know what happens and we're trying to protect you. And so then it doesn't become a battle when we're in high school. Wait a minute, you let me do this when I was in 5th grade. Why can't I do it when I'm in 10th grade? Because we've been instilling those healthy boundaries the whole time and they understand and they know. And so again, one of the things we've seen happen even in Joburg recently is matric. This whole matric weekend, these matric dances. Do you know how much ungodliness is happening and how this is pulling away our team, this kids that are... We had kids that were studying the Bible and wanting to become Christians until this time of the year has come. And now the world has taken over. Now you better believe we're training our kids now to think about when they get... They're not going on a matric trip. They're not going to be part of those. That's our choice as parents. You have to make your choice as parents. The second area talks about expectations. And there's a number of scriptures there that I'll let you look up on your own. But I want to talk about a few of these just practicals. We need to expect our kids to pray. We have to teach them how to pray. We teach them how to open the Bible. And you know what? They don't always like it. And this is one of the things that, you know, it's just disheartening. Sometimes when you sit down for family devotional, Monday night's our night. Monday is like religiously family night in the Pacta home. We don't schedule appointments. We don't have other things that happen. If some emergency comes up where we have to do something on a Monday, we automatically reschedule family night to be Tuesday and make sure everybody can be there because we're not going to have a week where we don't have a family night. That's one of our boundaries. We open the Bible, we talk, and sometimes, you know, when you ask your kids to pray, they, you know, and this is kind of the mistake I made a couple years ago. I said, "Would you like to pray for dinner tonight?" And one of my daughters says, "No." What do you mean you don't want to pray? You know, it's just hard. Sometimes when you have the family devotional, you just see them sitting there like... Now, if you have young kids, hopefully this isn't happening when they're 4 and 5. But by the time they start hitting high school, you know, sometimes they're just disinterested. And it doesn't mean you don't do it. But you also then have to figure out, how do I do this that's more engaging? And we constantly are reevaluating. How do we pull them in? How do we get them excited? What works for them? And you're constantly working on that, but you always still have family devotionals. It's what we do. You know what else we do? We go to church. We always go to church. We go to midweek. We go Sunday. We go when there's special events. It's not an option to not go to church. We go to church. And again, some parents, when their kids hit 12, 13, 14, and they start having an opinion back, mom and dad, back away. That's not what you do. That's the age of opportunity. That's when you step up and you teach why we do what we do, but it's still what we do. I asked one of my daughters, I said, what do you feel like has helped you spiritually with as we've raised you and having the expectation? She goes, one thing that's been always very clear is it's a family expectation that we go to church. She goes, I have friends, and we saw this happen in the church, who, their daughter, she's 13 years old. She didn't feel like going because she was tired on Sunday, so she got to stay at home. That's crazy. My 14-year-old saw that was crazy. We don't do that with school. We expect our kids to go learn arithmetic, math, and science, but we don't expect them to come learn about the Lord. That's crazy. Suicide, spiritually. Last thing is, with us, for boundaries and expectations, is chores. We've always expected our kids to have responsibilities in the home. They will be contributing members of the family. Dishes, folding laundry, picking up your room, you know, cleaning a bathroom. Why? We're training a work ethic into them. And again, so many kids grow up, they're just lazy. Everybody does everything for them. And then we want them to become Christians and they have no discipline. Amen? All right, let's talk about loving people. Turn to Proverbs chapter 11, please. Proverbs chapter 11. Loving people. Giving. Denying yourself. Proverbs chapter 11, verse 25. A generous man will prosper. He who refreshes others will refresh himself. Proverbs chapter 17. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 17 says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for diversity or adversity. What are these two scriptures telling us? It's recognizing the fact that, you know what, there's times that all of us don't feel like giving. We get selfish. We get discouraged. We come in and, I mean, I can't tell you how many times as a Christian I've walked into midweek service wishing I wasn't at midweek service. Or coming Sunday morning wishing I was sleeping in Sunday morning. Or am I alone in that? I mean, we're Christians, but we're human. And it's that decision when you walk in the door, I'm going to deny myself and give. And some of the best midweek services I remember having are the times when I didn't feel like being there and I had a horrible day and I just said, I'm checking self at the door and I'm going in to refresh others. And if I go in to refresh others, I'm going to come out refreshed. And it's true. I mean, it's like you just get transformed. We have to train our kids to be like this. So many of our kids, they come in, they plop themselves on a chair, they cross their arms and they pop in their earpod or their earphones from their iPod, and somehow we believe we're helping them become a Christian by bringing them to church. Where's the training? You know, again, for us, for our kids, iPods are left in the car. Therefore, when you are alone, they're not something you do publicly. They're something that you experience personally. So, when we're here, our phones are in our pockets, our iPods are put away, and we engage. We don't sit on a chair. We're involved in the fellowship. We train our kids to be that way. It's constant. Interacting. Socializing. Raising their hand in classes. Do you know how well your kids behave in the children's ministry, the kids zone? Have you ever taken time to just go by? When my kids were younger, we've always been in the ministry raising kids. So I wasn't in kids zone. I always had other things going on for the ministry. So I used to constantly come by and just look in the window and I want to see, how are they doing interacting in class? Are they the ones raising their hands? Are they socializing with the other kids? Asking the teachers, how are they doing? So that you can make sure you're addressing these problems at home and that you're training them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Giving. Okay, hospitality. Beth Pachtak.
I love this about God. I think He's so hospitable. John 14 talks about how He's going to heaven. He was going to prepare a place for us. And in verse 23, it says, "My Father will, if you obey His teaching, My Father will love Him, and we will come and make our home with Him." And I think hospitality is about, it's about making whatever you live in, wherever you are, a home. It's making an environment that is welcoming and shows consideration for those that come in. And that can be as simple as a cup of water. You know, it's a welcoming spirit. I love that you don't have to have a lot to be hospitable. You can just be hospitable with what you have. And it's one of the things I think of some of our good friends. I don't know if they were never in Cape Town, but they were Chantel and Wilner Cornelly. They were in the Johannesburg church in the ministry there and in Madagascar and Mauritius, and they're originally from Haiti. They were part of the church in Haiti. And they went down after the big, huge earthquake there and with all the relief work and did part of the relief work. And it was so inspiring to me when I saw the video footage that was taken there, and they had built this tent. Here, the entire country has been devastated, and this whole city, and the grounds that the church building used to be on was completely gone, and they had this one little tent set up. And the disciples all gathered back there and were checking on each other's families and things like that. And they got in a few supplies from Hope Worldwide, and they had their meager supplies, and they had to make their decision, shall we share? I mean, this whole community around us. They had very, very little, but there they were, and there was the disciples, the little tent set up and taking what they had. And you know what? It's like the loaves and fishes. A little bit goes a long way. And I think that's what God does. When we have a spirit of generosity and hospitality, He takes what we have and He makes us, you know, He spreads it around. I love that about God. But I think practically for hospitality, What I love is kids love to feel needed. From a very small age, when you put a little cup of water in their hand and you have them go offer it to a guest, or, you know, they provide that, it does something for them. I think even now, at the age my kids are at, when we're having someone over or a family's going to come over and we're going to spend some time with someone, I have them help me in the kitchen. Why don't you cut these up, and why don't you da-da-da? Then at dinner, when we're sitting around and we've had someone over, they're like, I made that. You know, they love that. I think, don't we all? We all want to feel needed. We want to feel included and like we have a place and a role. And I think whatever age our kids are, they can have that role and that place to learn hospitality. And I think it's interesting. I have a couple of scriptures on there, but it says to offer it without grumbling. And that can be a challenge sometimes in a busy environment. When we have a lot going on, maybe you lead a small group and you do this and you both work and you have small children and you can feel like you're running. And you can feel like, I want to have people over, but then they come and you're kind of in a bad mood because you had a long day or whatever. I love that it calls us to do it without grumbling. It just keeps our hearts in check. But I think it's something for the whole family. Whatever our kids' age are, they can be involved in hospitality.
Proverbs chapter 11, verse 30. By the way, you guys are good back there. You guys switching back, and you guys are good. Good AV guys. All right, Proverbs 11, verse 30. Heart for the mission. Look what it says in Proverbs 11:30. It says, "The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and he who wins souls is wise." Proverbs chapter 24. Verse 11. "Rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter." You know, God's heart has always been, and then we see this through the Scriptures, to save those that are lost. The whole Bible is the redemption story from Genesis 13 to Revelation 22. It is about our redemption and God wanting to see souls saved. It's something we have to train into our kids as well. For us, you know, we've had certain convictions as Christians that we've always wanted to make sure was true in our home. One is that they always saw us having people into our home that we studied the Bible with. It's a way of life. It's who we are as Christians. I studied the Bible with one young man a couple years ago in Chicago. It was 2005 that I got with him. And we were teaching him what it meant to be a disciple. And he'd grown up in the church. His family had actually moved multiple places for the church. And he says to me, you know, I used to see my parents live this way. They used to have people in the house all the time. But he said a couple years ago, and he's referring back to 03, he says, a couple years ago, it stopped. My parents no longer had people in the home. They weren't studying the Bible with people, and they weren't having discipling relationships regularly. Now, I'll tell you, one of the hardest things for me to do as a youth and family leader, a team leader, is to look at this young man and say, you know what? Your mom and dad are wrong. You need to do this because the Scriptures call you to, even in spite of mom and dad.
That's right.
Now, our hope is always, as those that get in and study the Bible with kids to help them become Christians, that we can say, you need to be like your mom and dad. One of the hardest things for us to do is to say, you need to do this in spite of mom and dad. Missions, offering, and contribution. Again, since our kids were little, every year when missions comes around and we're saving money and we're sacrificing and we don't go do something as a family because we're giving the money to missions, we've always used that as an opportunity to train them about the importance of making sacrifices to give to others to help them get saved. And I think probably the biggest thing for us is just trying to always maintain in our home that spirit of we're willing to go anywhere and do anything for the kingdom of God. Wherever God calls, that's where we're going to go. And I'll tell you, this has been very, 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 very in our faces over this last year. Because our kids were 13 and 4, actually they were 12 and 14 years old when this idea of moving to Africa came up. Now, if you have 12 and 14 year olds, you know how entrenched they are into their friends and their life at that moment. And this was one of the hardest things about our decision of we feel God calling us to move to Africa, do we move to Africa knowing where our kids are? And we wrestled and we prayed and we included them in the process and we brought them here with us to check it out and we discussed it as a family, but we prayed a lot that God would move on their hearts so that they would want to serve the way that we wanted to serve. And we ended up making this decision to come here as a family, and it hasn't been all roses, you know. I mean, the transition for them has been challenging at times. Adjusting to schools and new friends and new people and new friends. I mean, everything. It's been very, very, very new. But for me, one of the most encouraging things happened probably a month and a half ago. My 14-year-old has been studying the Bible and she wants to be a disciple. And when she came to us, she came to us on August 24th and she says, "Mom and Dad, can I talk to you?" And we pulled her in the other room and says, "Sure, what's going on?" And she says, "What do I need to change? I want to be a disciple." And, you know, Beth and I did everything in our power to withhold our enthusiasm. We're like, "Oh, that's great. Let's talk about this." You know, I mean, this is the dream you have for your kids. And one of the things we talked about, she says, "Dad, I want to study the Bible with some of the sisters, but I'd really like to study discipleship with you and learn what it means to be a disciple." And so we got together that Monday and we studied out what a disciple was. We did kind of part one. And the next week we got together and we did a follow-up study. This is kind of what discipleship means, part two. And she looked at me and she says, "Dad, this had to be really hard for you." And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Knowing what you know and how important this is to you, it seems like it would have taken everything in your power to not try to make me a disciple from the day I was born." I said, "You have no idea the restraint that Mom and I, you know, constantly try to show, because we want you to do this on your terms. So we've always built this in you, but we've wanted you to do this on your terms." And I said, "So Hannah, do you want this? Is this the life that you want to live?" She says, "Yeah, I absolutely want to be a disciple." She said, "I really see that you and Mom live this life." Now, that is like the greatest compliment to me I could ever have as a parent. That my kids, and Beth and I always talk about this, we're not perfect parents. We make constant mistakes. We have struggles. Our kids, I mean, we could do a whole class on all the challenges we've had, but this is being recorded and we're trying to protect our children. We'll talk to you offline about our own problems and challenges. But what Beth and I always talk about is this: we cannot be perfect parents. It's impossible. But we can be disciples. And if we model that go anywhere, do anything for the kingdom of God heart, and they see us walking with God, and loving people, then they will want that life. And I'm telling you, from the time they were 9, 10, 11, they started seeing the difference with us and their friends' parents. And now that they're getting older, they're able to articulate this is the life that they want to live. Beth will talk a little bit here about the poor.
I want to share here in Acts chapter 9, verse 36, about one of my heroes in the Bible. It says, "In Joppa there was a disciple named Tabitha, which when translated is Dorcas, who was always doing good and helping the poor." She goes on in the story and dies, and then Peter raises her from the dead, which is amazing, of course. But I love the one line that's written about her life, that she was always doing good and loving the poor. And I think of people like that in the Bible, that I always think, you know, Dave was talking about, you don't have to be perfect, you just have to be a disciple. And I always hope that, okay, God, I'm not a Jeremiah or an Isaiah. There's not going to be a whole book in the Bible about me entitled Beth. But maybe I could just have one line. Maybe there could just be one line in the Bible about me. And if so, what would my dream that line would say? What would that dream be? I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe no one ever has. Maybe you don't think about it that way. But I have. And it's made me. I actually have started keeping a little journal of all my one-line heroes in the Bible. That there's very little known about them. But what is known about them is spectacular. And that's what I think about. She's always doing good and loving the poor. Wouldn't that be awesome to just have that be what you're known for? I think that's very inspiring to me. But I think I was kind of raised in one of those homes. I'm the youngest of 9 kids, and there wasn't my parents had been married 65 years, and this last month or two, my dad turned 90 and my mom turned 87. So they have had full lives, and I feel very, very blessed to be the one of 9 children. And there was not always a lot to eat. You know, we always had food, mostly that my parents had grown. But my dad he's American Indian, and we were raised on an Indian reservation in the Midwest area. And so growing up in that environment, it's not that our needs were not always met. They were always met. But there was times when things felt scarce and when a lot of responsibility was put on us at a very young age we had jobs from very young ages and things like that. So I think about, not that I would ever classify myself as, oh, we were so poor or something like that, but I think with my parents, they very much wanted us to have a heart of generosity. They wanted us to appreciate what we had and always look after people that were less fortunate than us. And I think, though, the way that I interpreted that sometimes was a lot of guilt. Like, oh, man, I got to eat today, so, oh, sheesh. You know, how dare I eat? And, you know, I think I've been in a life journey of just dealing with guilt or feeling bad for what I have or not processing it well. So I think I share all that to say, I think we're all on a journey like that, not in just this regard, but in a lot of processing spiritual things. And this area, particularly for me, I've had a very hard time processing. I slip back and I hear myself saying things like, there are starving kids and how dare you not finish those peas? Or like these things want to come out of my mouth. And I'm like, do I really feel like she has to eat peas to prove she's grateful? Or, you know, like I find myself asking all these questions of myself. What am I really trying to communicate here? I'm trying to communicate gratitude, and I'm trying to communicate generosity with whatever you have. Let it spill over and bless those around you. And whatever that means for you, however you process that, I think that's loving the poor and the oppressed. I think it's when you steadily, you're not in a perfect place and having all the answers, but you're someplace and you're processing it and you're trying to translate that and make it a great situation for your kids. I think with the oppressed part, I think of it's just not physically poor. I think a big area we're in right now is teenagers, as you know, can tend toward a group that they feel they relate to or that's comfortable to them, and people that they want to associate with more are people that are just like them. I think we've talked a lot about who's the lonely person. When you walk into a situation, is there somebody, do they have a friend? Are they alone? And maybe we wouldn't think of that necessarily as poor and oppressed, but I think there's people in all of our churches, honestly, that sometimes just come and go, and maybe they are not connected. They don't have people in their lives, and someone didn't greet them that Sunday. I think that's kind of the practical right now that we're focusing on with our kids is who are those people, and are we being generous with ourselves and grateful for what we have?
Okay. As we conclude, I want to one more thing that has to go on the board. And I want us to think about, because there's two tendencies of how we respond to a class or a day like today. And you can see if you identify with either of these. Overly guilty. Or clueless. Now they tend to fall along gender lines. But we won't say which is which. All right. When you sit and you listen to a lot of this, it can be very overwhelming. And hopefully we're not here. We do feel some conviction from some of this. We've got to find the healthy place to land. And I have to say, I was actually talking to the moms about this last night as well. Our kids watch us. Our kids know how we process things. If we come home and we get prideful, arrogant, or self-righteous, like, I just learned that I've not been doing such and such with you as a parent, and things are going to change around here. That's not a good way to approach change. To come home and say, you know what, I was really convicted today. I learned some things that I need to be doing better as a parent to help you. And let's talk about this as a family. Because our goal is to please God, and we want to, as a family, please God. It's a very different spirit in how we approach things. And I really want to encourage us to think about, and the reason we kind of started picking this back up and going back, is this is about real Christianity, and a real Christian marriage, and real Christian parenting. And we sin all the time by what we do and by what we don't do that we're supposed to do. Where the grace of God lies is in the blood of Christ when we're humble. When we're open with each other saying, wow, there's a lot of things I need to change in my parenting. There's a lot of things I need to start doing in my parenting. Thank goodness for the grace of God. And your kids are going to see that in you. They're going to see you respond to the Bible and become better as a result of what you've experienced. That's what our kids need to see in us. Not self-righteous, religious mom and dad. Does that make sense? All right, a few minutes of Q&A. Did today or this second session spark any thoughts, questions, bad attitudes? That's a loaded question. How old are your kids?
I've got 16 and 7. 15 months old, niece, but we take care of us. And 9 months old, baby.
Okay. Now, I'm going to say something. I don't know anything about you, your life, your walk with God, anything. So I want to say something in general. The question was, she said she works a full-time job. She has 3 children that she's taking care of. It's very difficult to come home and be giving to the kids when you're just completely drained from what you've experienced at work. And how do you deal with that? Okay. And again, this isn't personal. This is a general principle. I believe, and I think what the Scriptures teach, is that above all, our kids need us. They need us more than they need a nice home. They need us more than they need a private school. They need us more than a lot of the things that we often interpret that our kids need. And again, I'm not picking on you. I'm just saying, ideally, both mom and dad would be able to be home training and raising and spending time with the kids, but modeling good work ethic. If you're in a situation where it's at all possible for you to get a job that's less demanding, and maybe that means you scale down your life so that you can be emotionally, spiritually present for your kids, that is the win-win-win situation. If you literally, to put food on the table, must be working, both of you, then you must find a way to work through your own emotions so that when you walk in the door, you can give to your kids. Because the truth of the matter is, as I had up here earlier, we have 18 years to form Christ in our kids. And when that 18 years is gone, that opportunity is gone. The way that Beth and I, from the time we started having kids, we prayed when Hannah was in the womb, Father, this is your child. You are entrusting her to us for a short period of time to teach her about you. And ultimately, we're turning her back over as your child. And we have a responsibility when we become parents to do everything we can to help them. So, I know this ties into a whole other line of thinking, but I think we very often get caught up in what we think we need from a material side that puts us in compromising situations with our families. Other thoughts? Questions?
Thank you for that last comment, man. I think I was about to set things right on my own. My sons are, my one's 13, the other one's just about 11. So I'm just sort of a year behind you. I think both my sons love God. We pray together as a family, we read together. And my oldest son is sort of, you know, there's a sort of a switch that flicks when they turn 13. Suddenly he's become a little more mature. He wants to do more mature things. And what I'd like to know is how can I effectively help him to learn how to have a great quiet time with God?
A good quiet time, did you say?
Yeah. Have that personal relationship with God. How do I teach that? I mean, we've been reading together, we've talked through it, he sees how I think. But how do I get that going?
Does he want to? There's a phase our kids go through, okay? When they're younger, they don't really have a choice. I mean, you're having family devotionals. For us, there are certain battles that we choose to fight spiritually, and there's others that we don't. We've always wanted to plant seeds, and instill faith. So things like, we always pray for meals. We always talk about things over dinner. We always have family devotionals. We've not forced our kids to have quiet times. When they're interested, and when we can try to draw interest in they, because this has been our take. Their walk with God is their walk with God. They're going to be raised in a spiritual home, and we're going to do what we can. But when they start doing their quiet times, it's either going to be because, hey, they want to hang out with mom, and she's having a quiet time, so you know they're small, and you color in your book, and let's read a devotional, and let's do something together. What's a book you're interested in? It's always been waiting for them to have these moments where they're interested in taking it personal. Does that help? Now then, when they do get to that age, then you have to figure out what connects with them at 13. And again, let me tell you, even the transition that my 14-year-old has been through. When she was 13, reading one scripture and having a thought about it was about what she could handle. And it was 5 to 10 minutes, and that was it. Now what's happening is that she's becoming interested herself. She's even come back and said, you know, I'm finding that reading one scripture isn't giving me what I need spiritually. She says, I come to devotional on Saturday, church on Sunday. I feel all ready to go spiritually. And then my Tuesday, Wednesday, because of school and everything, I'm feeling myself spiritually go like this. And so then it's like, well, see, Hannah, that's why quiet times are so important. So part of now what you have to do is learn, how do I get more from my time with God? And so you see what I mean? We're doing it in stages she can handle instead of forcing that on them. Okay? In the back. Great question. 2.5 and 4, it's all about two things, singing and acting. Very little scripture. I mean, there's going to be plenty of time for them to see where this stuff comes from. But we sang. I mean, when they were that young, we did a lot of singing. And as Beth was talking about doing the kind of acting things out, like how do you give someone a hug? And maybe that's the family devotional. How do we greet someone when they come to the door? That's family devotional. How do we answer an adult when they talk to us? And do you look them in the eyes? That's a devotional. Everything was about drama. And if you're not, honestly, if you tend to be more cerebral, it may do good for you to spend a session in ages 2, 3, 4, 5 in Kid Zone. Spend 3 months in there. Learn how those kids interact and work. And that's a great training tool, because the way that our curriculum works in our churches is we've really geared it to the different ages. And that's a great benefit for us as parents. So there's going to be ages we all feel more equipped than others because of how we're wired. And when we don't feel equipped, we step into kid zone and we learn as we're giving. So I would highly encourage you to do that. One last thing, have family devotionals with other families. Learn from each other. Borrow ideas from each other. But make sure that you keep it age appropriate.
I just want to know two things. One is the little ones. Painting them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem doing that. I think it's a problem that I don't have a problem with doing that because you must not be angry when you stand them. Okay, that's why I fail now. And I've tried, but when I think this warrants thinking, that's what I do. I don't have time to go with him or her privately and talk. I don't know, maybe it's about being wired up differently to my wife, but that is one challenge. The second one is also spanking, I think. There comes a time, I've got a 14-year-old daughter, and we're blending family, and I believe spanking, at that age, it's not working. It's never going to work.
No, it shouldn't at 14.
But then I also make a mistake of telling her that, for example. Okay, I'm not going to spank you, blah, 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 and we talk. But then now, why are you using that, for example, that you're not going to spank me? Whenever my daughter does something, she knows that dad is not going to spank me because he said he's done with spanking. So,
okay.
Is it wrong with me or is it wrong with the parent?
Two very good questions. Yeah.
Because there comes a time when you feel like, whoa, because you only told me. So I've thought that the last one is like, it's now motivating little ones. House chores, doing the dishes. And then, is it wise to use money? Doing dishes, maybe it's $10. And
you mean to pay them if they do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a way of motivating as well.
Okay, that's three now. How far are we going? Because, I mean, let me address those briefly, okay? Okay. First of all, on anger and spanking, the reality is, as parents, we are angry when we discipline our kids. The question is how you control your anger. I mean, we don't feel happy, pleasant feelings when our child goes and puts their finger through our DVD player and breaks it. You know, it's anger isn't wrong. How you deal with your anger. If your anger turns into abusing your child, then there's a problem. And you need help with your boundaries. But I remember one of the elders that used to help us said, I don't think I've ever spanked my kid when I wasn't angry. I mean, does that make sense? There's a righteous indignation and anger. That's what we're protecting them from, is we're trying to turn around their response. Now, spanking, just in general, there's a couple things that have to happen. You have to be in a controlled environment. They have to feel safe when they're spanked. Now, safe when you're spanked means, look, I know I'm going to get whooped on my behind, but I'm not afraid. What we don't want to create is that if dad's angry, he turns around and slaps me across the face. I mean, that's what I mean. Discipline is supposed to be a very controlled experience. And where you can say, son, what you did was wrong. Come here. I'm going to spank you. And you bend them over and you whack, whack, and you let them cry a little bit. They need to get out that emotion. And then once they do and they settle down, you say, now, daddy loves you. This is why you were disciplined. Let's pray together. Let's reconcile. And then you make sure there's full reconciliation. And then that's done. That's the proper discipline. Okay, now with ages, look, I think by the time your kids are able, when they're squirming trying to get their nappy changed for you to slack them, you know, and they sit still, you know, I think there's an age. And then when they start getting to be one or two and they're toddling around and they reach for things and you say no, and they look at you and then they still do it, and you grab their little hand and you smack their little hand, that's okay. You know, make sure you support their wrist so you're not breaking their wrist when you spank them. But then there comes a point when they're probably 2, 3 where that doesn't sting enough. And that's when you turn to the rear end and you need a nice little not say a weapon, tool. We had, for us, you know, we used a wooden plank that we had one of the brothers who's a woodworker make, and it was about that thick, and it was just like this, and fit nice in the hand, and it did the job really well. It was always in the same place, and it was always in a controlled environment. Now, I would say for us, by the time they were 9, 10, 11, depending on the child, is when that stops. And then you shift gears. Discipline changes because they change. Spanking them turns into you lose privileges. Or you don't get to go to your friends, or you're going to do extra chores. What you have to do is you've got to connect their heart with the discipline. So we found, and for our kids, they're different. One of my kids, if I take away her phone, now she's, you know, now that they have phones, if I take away her phone, you might as well put her in prison for a day. So for her, she knows, and we just had a conversation last week about this with chores. He said, your chores, and they know this, you are to do the dishes and clean up the kitchen every night after dinner. That's your job. If it's not done right away, or if it's not done completely, you lose your phone for a day. And so we've got to make sure then as parents that we enforce that. That if they actually don't do the job, hand me your phone. You lose it, you get it back tomorrow. But discipline changes as your kids get older. Does that answer your question? So then when you got to make sure that the threat matches the discipline. That we stop threatening them with spanking, because spanking is not appropriate, but we threaten them with other things, and then we follow through with the discipline. Was there a third thing? We don't have time for the third thing. Sorry.
We want to stick to the schedule that we promised, which is 12:30, and then that's in about 3 minutes. You can, again, the third thing you can check with